It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, a journalist looks at whether the rising salaries for college football coaches are worthwhile investments.
First, the Wisconsin State Assembly is taking up a set of bills today that would change the way food aid recipients get their benefits in the state. The Republican lawmakers behind these bills say they're necessary to crack down on fraud and waste, but opponents of these bills say they could increase hunger in the state.
Jesse Appoyan is here to break down the new legislation for us. She's a political reporter for the Capital Times. Jesse, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, big picture, if all this passed, what would change in the way people get food share and unemployment benefits in the state?
There are sort of four major changes, three targeting the food share program and one that deals with unemployment. So one of the changes would be all of the electronic benefit transfer, the EBT cards, would have to be printed with a photo ID for the person who uses that card, or for each family member who would be using that card. The clerks who approve those purchases aren't allowed to actually check the photos, and the bill's authors acknowledge that and is kind of hoping that this is something that could be set up to be more in use down the road. A second proposal would deal with replacement cards. So if someone is asking for, I think it's a fourth replacement card. Yep, after three replacement cards, after the fourth card, the participant would be notified that they could be investigated for fraud. And sort of with each subsequent request, it'd be a series of warning letters leading to an investigation for fraud. The third bill related to food stamps would just expunge any unused food share benefits from an account that hasn't been used in 6 or more months, and then the person using that account would have to ask for it to be reactivated in order to get back to those benefits. And then the fourth bill dealing with unemployment, anyone who deliberately hides information or provides faulty information in order to qualify for unemployment benefits would be barred from receiving those benefits for 7 years.
Before we get into some of the pros and cons on each of those, it's the overall intent here, the argument is there is significant fraud in these benefits, and the Republican legislators are trying to crack down on that. Is that the general reasoning here?
Yeah, that's the general reasoning. Also, even if it's small amounts of fraud, I think the general argument behind it is that in order to earn the taxpayers' trust, in order to earn the trust of the public, that these programs are being used properly and as they're designed. The Republicans who have supported the bills are saying, you know, we need to make these good faith efforts to show that, you know, we're looking into the way that programs are being used.
Now, with this photo ID, in effect, having photos on the food aid cards, we talked to one of the lawmakers involved in that, Jesse Kramer, a while back. As I understand it, we would need a federal waiver on the way that would be used in his original proposal?
That's correct. And I guess the hang-up on that one is that federal law prohibits clerks from treating someone who's making a purchase with food stamps any differently from someone who's making a purchase with, say, a credit card or cash. You know, so since a credit card or a debit card doesn't necessarily have a photo ID on it, and a clerk wouldn't be checking for that, the clerk then could not also check an EBT card for that photo ID.
And so this new legislation would still have the photo on the benefit card, but as opposed to the original legislation, now not require store clerks to confirm, to check that photo against the person using it.
That's correct.
And so it doesn't really make any change at present, but as you mentioned, this is something that maybe they would go for that waiver down the road, and then we'd have that photo ID in place.
Yeah, he did sort of suggest that this might possibly prevent some trafficking just by deterring people from maybe selling a card, you know, that wouldn't have a photo that matches. But I think the main goal is in the mind of the Republicans that, you know, maybe if a Republican president is elected and the federal administration changes, you know, that might, a new administration might be more likely to make a change to that policy at the federal level.
Talking to Jesse Appoyan from the Capital Times about proposed changes in food aid here in Wisconsin and unemployment benefits aimed at cracking down fraud. Well, you mentioned the trafficking of cards, and that's the main point, it sounds like, of the legislation you mentioned on the number of replacement cards. So the idea is that if, hey, somebody keeps wanting replacement cards, maybe they're selling those, trading them for something?
Yeah, that's the concern. And the Department of Health Services actually implemented that policy just as a pilot policy in 2013 So the DHS has already been sending these letters and doing this for a little while, but this would put that into law, you know, in case a subsequent governor maybe wanted to, you know, get rid of that rule.
And then finally, the unused food share benefits. So if I don't use my benefits card for 6 months, this just would freeze that account?
Yes. Yep. It would freeze the account. And then in addition to that, even if you were still using the account, any benefits more than a year old would also be seized after a year. And the idea for that is to, I think there have been a few cases of people carrying over large amounts of benefits from 1 month to the next, and it's not necessarily prevalent, but it has happened and is something that that bill's author wanted to target.
So we've heard the arguments in favor of these as we've been talking. Jesse, what's been the response? What's the opposition to this trio of legislation?
And the opposition is that these bills are designed to stigmatize poverty, designed to shame people who need these benefits. And there's concern, especially among people who work in, you know, organizations like the Hunger Task Force, that something like the photo ID bill could just make it harder for people to go, you know, go to the store, get these things. Maybe you send a neighbor to go, you know, get your groceries for you, and that neighbor can't use the card because they don't have the matching photo. Things like that. Just sort of putting up roadblocks that make it more difficult. The unemployment bill, the concerns there are that application process can be complicated and people can make honest mistakes, and you know, people are concerned with anyone being penalized for, you know, simply making a mistake on the application.
Right, and again, the idea there is that if you have misrepresented yourself on unemployment applications twice, you're basically out of the loop for a number of years, right?
Correct, yeah. It's a two strikes and you're out for 7 years. Now, the bill's author did say today that there would be some safeguards in place to sort of suss out, you know, whether it was an intentional fraud or, you know, the result of a mistake. So, it sounds like there will be some checks to make sure that doesn't happen.
So four pieces of legislation all told that we've been talking about, are they seen as likely to pass in the Assembly?
Yes. They have pretty broad support among Republicans. Obviously, it's a split on party lines, and Democrats are opposed to this, but they are in the minority, and Republicans should be able to pass it.
And then what's next out of the Assembly? Sometimes we've seen, and we're seeing that now, actually legislation make it through the Assembly. Not necessarily a sure thing, even though there's also Republican control in the Senate.
Yeah, and there hasn't been a whole lot of talk in the Senate about when these would be taken up, simply because there's been so much focus on what the Senate's going to do with a couple of other bills that it's looking at right now.
And let's briefly talk about that. There is expected to be some floor action in the Senate on campaign finance legislation, possibly today. Not today. What's happening instead?
Yeah, it sounded like they might have been on the floor today taking up the GAB redesign and the campaign finance changes, but they caucused and met today, and it sounds like they will also not be on the floor tomorrow. So they're still trying to win over, it sounds like, about four Republican senators who are either on the fence or haven't come around to supporting those bills yet.
And clock's ticking there.
Clock is ticking. There is a chance, it hasn't been said for sure, but there is a chance that they could end up having to call an extraordinary session if they do want to pass these bills in the next week or two.
Jesse, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Jesse Apoyan, political reporter for the Capital Times, with us to talk about bills taken up by the Assembly today that would change the way food aid recipients get their benefits here in Wisconsin. The college football season is well in full swing. It's been a successful season overall for a lot of coaches, especially when it comes to their salaries.
USA Today has been tracking how much universities pay their football coaches over the last 10 years. And in that time, the pay has doubled, with the average compensation coming in at just at over $2 million a year.
Wisconsin's head coach is right in that mix, too. And with many college football coaches out earning professors and administrators, some are starting to ask, is it all worth it?
For more on coaches' salaries and the growth of college football, we're joined by Gilbert Gall. He's a two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and the author of Billion Dollar Ball, A Journey Through the Big Money Culture of College Football. Gilbert, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me on the show.
Well, what do college football coaches make today at places like UW-Madison?
Well, at Madison, it's I think the current coach is getting about $2.1 million. I may be off $100,000 here or there on that figure because the prior coach left and it went down a little bit. But at the large schools, the 65 or so schools in the so-called five power conferences, it ranges from $7.1 million for Nick Saban down at Alabama to, as you mentioned a moment ago, about an average of $2 million. There's now about 10 coaches earning an average of about $5 million a year.
Well, give us a sense how much that's changed in recent years.
Well, it's changed dramatically, and the change dovetails the monetization of college football over the last decade and a half. When I began research on my book, Billion Dollar Ball, I noticed that there had been an extraordinary run-up in the scale of college football, and by scale I mean the finances. So what happened basically beginning in the mid-'80s was the athletic directors figured out that there was such a demand for college football that they could charge extraordinary sums to fans to secure a seat at their stadium for tickets, and then they negotiated incredibly lucrative television fee deals, including in the Big Ten through the Big Ten Network. And finally, there was just an abundance of corporate money. So they figured out how to make an extraordinary amount of money, and as they did, the coaches, not surprisingly, began to say, you know what, we want a larger slice of the pie.
So this is college football we're talking about. It's not the professional league. So what is the justification for paying coaches so much money?
Well, you know, it depends who you speak with. There really is no plausible explanation if you believe that college sports are still part of an educational experience and not a commercial business. The reality, of course, is they are a commercial business when we talk about college football and men's basketball, possibly a few teams involving women's basketball. But all the other sports, the Olympic sports, women's running, the rest of them, they don't make any revenue. So the justification ultimately boils down to the fact that these coaches are responsible for putting an awful lot of people in the stands week after week and generating basically at a school like Wisconsin probably in the neighborhood of somewhere between 50 and 75% of all the revenue that comes into the athletic department. So it's a business justification, which has nothing really to do with the education.
Barry Alvarez, a UW-Madison football coaching legend, has weighed in on this, and he says this is just what the market demands. What is the argument about the market?
Well, it's basically what I just said. I mean, the argument is that the coaches and their agents, they all have big-time agents now, just as professional coaches do, are responsible for all this money, and that there's a limited supply of coaches who are capable of producing winning teams year after year after year and filling the stadium and attracting all of this money. So that basically is the argument for why they need to be paid this much. Now, that conveniently avoids all kinds of really important contextual questions, such as, well, wait a second, you're not paying any taxes on this money, on none of this money that's coming in. You're not paying a cent in taxes. And that's all because of the idea that college football is still somehow covered by the umbrella of tax exemption, that it's part of the charitable enterprise that a college university is supposed to be. Now, there's such a fundamental contradiction there that it's almost preposterous, but the schools still continue to work both sides of the street, claiming that, you know, well, we're really nonprofits, we're really charities, and at the same time operating, at least in the terms of college football, as a commercial enterprise.
We're talking to author and journalist Gilbert Gahl, talking about the growth of college football coach salaries and where they're going from here. Now, Wisconsin's Chancellor Rebecca Blank has said that she'd like to create a salary cap for college football coaches. I don't know. Is there any chance that that could happen? Where is that?
Good luck with that happening. No, there's no chance of that happening anytime soon. The business model of college football is so big and so powerful at this point in time that I really don't see anything threatening it in the near term. And when I say near term, I'm saying really about 5 years, possibly as long as 10 years. At that point, things begin to become problematic for the model. There's a series of forces at play that will eventually play out, and they involve paying players, they involve the tax status, they involve technological disruption, threats to the business model. And I also throw in there that I think the younger students are a little less avid in their support of college football compared with, say, people my age. I'm 64, grandparents and the students' parents. They just don't have the loyalty because they're a little more distracted by all these things in their hands.
So what are the issues at stake there? You mentioned what the college athletes, the football players themselves make, and they don't make on par with, it sounds like, what the coaches make. They don't make anything. So what does this mean for what this argument is going in the future?
So it depends how you think about all this. If you believe that it's really a business model, sort of the minor leagues for the NFL, and they're generating all this money, and it's the players responsible for it, well, then you sort of side with the idea, well, let's pay these players, money to play college football. And I'm talking about more than a couple thousand dollars for the so-called cost of attendance. I'm talking about, possibly tens of thousands of dollars, if not even more, if you get to a model where you're bidding for five-star high school players. That's one argument. If you believe that what's occurred in college football, as I do, is a distortion of the mission of these large universities, even a perversion of their mission, then you're a little less sympathetic to the notion of turning the college football team into a minor league for the NFL, and hence you're a little more suspect about the idea of paying players tens of thousands of dollars. It completely disrupts and challenges the mission of the universities if you do that.
In terms of critics who might look at these salaries and say, this is way too much, this is college football, what is the case to be made that, on the other hand, the revenue coming in does a lot to float the university as a whole and the education of all the students who go there?
Wait a second. The amount of money that is transferred from athletic departments to academics is de minimis. I mean, it's a very small percentage of the money that comes in. What I found is that when you analyze the finances of the athletic departments, I mean, clearly the money stays in the athletic departments. Now, in a positive sense, you can argue that, okay, but that money, football, is underwriting sports like women's rowing at Wisconsin, which, I spent several days with Phoebe Bryans and her team there and was just absolutely blown away by the coach and by the rowers and by the fact that this is still truly the old model of college athletics, kind of the old amateur approach to athletics. So you could argue that football is paying for women's rowing at Wisconsin. And the flip side of that, of course, is that without women's rowing and those big numbers to offset the football numbers, I'm talking about Title IX, college football would be in big trouble at Wisconsin and the rest of the schools in the Big Ten and the other conferences. So those are sort of the arguments.
Well, then you've also got a situation at the UW system where there's big budget cuts coming down the pike, and the university has asked for more returns from the football program. So in that sense, there is some payback there. Is that the sort of thing you think that should factor into the equation of what coaches are made?
Yeah. I don't know if it is or it isn't, but I want to see that play out. I want to see where you get to a point where college football is actually contributing real money to academics, as opposed to plowing the money back into these gigantic salaries, the salaries of the nine full-time assistant coaches, the back office operations, and the rest of it. I had actually had an interesting conversation with my wife where we said, well, how much would be enough for college football to kind of justify what it's doing? And I came down to the argument that, well, it ought to be at least 25% of the money that they're bringing in. That would be a real contribution. And with all of this additional television money coming in through things like the Big Ten Network and the SEC Network and the Pac-12 Network, I would argue that the presidents, if they had any guts, they would say to their athletic directors, at least 50% of that money needs to go to academics. If we're going to continue to pose and pretend that things like college football are truly part of the educational mission of the university and not a pure commercial enterprise, which I think it is today for these really rich schools.
So you floated that 25% figure conversation with your wife. Is anyone else saying that? Is that something that you could
say? No. We were just having an interesting conversation about it. I can't remember the context of how it came up, but it did. No, nobody else is floating that. There are a few people who you know, I think fairly, you know, probably agree with the general argument that I'm making about this in terms of, you know, why not more money going to academics. But, you know, it's really sort of shocking how silent the presidents are about this. On the one hand, they put out reports year after year claiming that, you know, this is all out of control, the spending's out of control, and then they throw up their hands and say, but we're powerless to do anything about it. Somebody help us, please. Well, who's going to help them? The NCAA's not going to help them. I mean, they're in bed on all of this. Congress isn't going to help them because Congress clearly has protected the tax status, the privileged tax status of college football for at least three or four decades.
And we leave it there. So Gilbert, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, you're welcome.
That was Gilbert Gull talking about the growth of college football coach salaries and where they're going.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Prison reform has been front and center on the national stage in the last few days. Yesterday, President Obama announced that federal agencies would stop asking about criminal backgrounds in the early stages of the hiring process, part of an effort to help inmates successfully find jobs. Here he is in his weekly radio address.
I believe we can help those who have served their time and earned a second chance get the support they need to become productive members of society.
And starting last Friday, federal prisons started releasing some inmates, shortening their prison terms under new sentencing guidelines for nonviolent drug-related offenses. Over 6,000 federal inmates are expected to be released.
Margo Schlanger joins us now to see how this all fits into the big picture of incarceration in the United States. She's a professor of law at the University of Michigan Law School and the founder and director of the Civil Rights Litigation Clearinghouse. Margo, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
How significant is this release of 6,000 federal prisoners?
Well, I think it's symbolically significant. It's not a very large number of people in light of the enormous number of incarcerated folks we have in this country.
And how do federal prisons fit into the overall landscape of the American prison population?
Well, today there are 2.2 million people in jail and prison in the United States. It's a very, very high rate of imprisonment, and a third of them are in county and city jails. About 60% are in state prison, and 10% are in federal prison. So the federal prison population is large. It's the largest prison system in America, but it's still just 10% of the incarcerated people in America.
So in terms of addressing the problems of mass incarceration, the issues therein, are you saying that this release is maybe just the start?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that it marks a mindset that's really important, which is a mindset that it's time to get people who are not productively confined in prison out of prison. If it's safe and useful to get people out of prison, then let's do it. But it's not that it's a very large number of people. Every month, the federal prison system, the Bureau of Prisons, releases, say, 4,500 people a month. So 6,000 is, you know, 6 weeks' worth of releases from an average year.
And when you say you look at it from the perspective of are these inmates productively confined, what do you mean by that? What sorts of things are you thinking about?
Well, I'm thinking that if you think about prison as serving a function of deterrence or incapacitation, that it's pretty clear that deterrence is not much furthered by incremental increases in sentencing, that for deterrence purposes, 8 years and 10 years are not very different, and that for incapacitation, some people who have gotten their act together, who have the ability to get their act together, if you let them out of prison, they don't need to be incapacitated from society. They need to be given appropriate supports in society so that they can have law-abiding lives on the outside.
And how do the powers that be determine who those people are?
Well, you know, they use a whole variety of different methods. So there's a lot of different kind of evaluative methodology that has gone into figuring out who these 6,000 people are, where they are all folks in on drug felonies, and they all went through a process to be determined that it would be appropriate to let them out. In the ordinary course, the answer is that we used to have a lot more systems in place to try to figure out when it might make sense to let somebody out of prison, and we've let go of those systems, and we've substituted the idea that everybody has to do nearly all of their sentence, that they can't, that there can't be discretionary sentencing at the tail end, that we can't say, well, why don't you do half, and then we'll reassess. That used to be very mainstream, and the idea that when somebody gets through a chunk of their sentence, it might make sense to take a second look and see if they could be let go. That's one of the ideas that's, you know, very much in play now.
In terms of the big picture questions here, is there starting to be general agreement that there are too many people in prisons and jails?
Well, I don't know about general agreement, but there's starting to be a lot of states and a lot of people who are coming to that conclusion. I mean, there are places that are resisting it too, so I don't want to say it's universal, but yes, there's beginning to be a real momentum behind the idea that 2.2 million people in jail and prison is too many, that if we have 5% of the world's population, we shouldn't have over 20% of its prisoners.
We're talking to Margot Schlanger from the University of Michigan, where she's a law professor, looking at the release of 6,000 nonviolent federal inmates, which started on Friday, and the bigger picture of mass incarceration in the United States. Now, so far, a lot of attention has been paid to nonviolent inmates, but is focusing only on nonviolent offenders, is that enough to make a big difference in these numbers of people that we're talking about who are incarcerated?
Well, it can make a real difference, and I think that the way to solve mass incarceration is to carve off, you know, 10%, 15% of the population at a time. Looking at nonviolent offenders can do that, but it's not going to get it down by half or down by two-thirds. If that's the goal, and I think that would be a great goal, then thinking about just nonviolent offenders isn't going to get us there.
So how do we start looking at the problem, not the problem, but the prospect, I should say, of releasing those who may have some violence attached to their sentence?
Well, I think we have to think about different components of the prison and jail population individually and think about each of them with separate kinds of procedures and support. So, for example, if you take some of the people who are in jail and prison who have acute mental illness, you can get them out if you offer them various kinds of community supports that keep them from the problems that got them in the first place. If you take the folks who are drug addicted and you give them drug treatment and supports, you can get them out. If you take the people who are in jail who are there because they can't make bail, and you reform bail, you can get a whole chunk of people out. So you can do a lot of different things, one component at a time. It's not going to be a one-size-fits-all. It's not going to be a silver bullet. There's going to have to be a set of strategies, each one targeted at a different component of the population.
Will there be safety risks or concerns about safety risks if we incarcerate fewer violent offenders?
Well, I think, you know, I count on it that out of the 6,000 people who are getting released, that some of them are going to do something bad. I mean, you know, we have to expect that out of when you have a big number of people, we have to be prepared for some of them to make really quite serious mistakes. The question isn't, is this without risk? The question is it on balance? On the risk-benefit calculus, is it a risk worth taking? Where if we can get 6,000 people out of prison and save the money that keeps them in prison and help them lead productive lives and reattach them to their families and get them into the community, is that worth it? And you have to also remember that, you know, people commit offenses in prison too. I mean, so it's not as if sending somebody to prison means that they're never going to do anything bad ever again. So that's a lot of words that I just said that come to the point of nothing is without risk.
We're talking to University of Michigan Law Professor Margot Schlanger, looking at the release of 6,000 nonviolent federal inmates, which started on Friday, and a bigger picture of mass incarceration in the United States.
You can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. Do you see mass incarceration as a major problem in the U.S.? If so, what do you think needs to change? Have you had firsthand experience with this issue? If so, call in and share your perspective. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We continue our conversation with Margot Schlanger from the University of Michigan Law School. We're looking at mass incarceration and prison reform in the United States with the ongoing release of about 6,000 federal inmates.
You can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. Should we have shorter criminal sentences? Do we need more alternatives to incarceration? Have you been part of the correction system as a worker there, a lawyer, or an inmate yourself? What do you think needs to change? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And let's look now at conditions in jails and prisons. You've done a lot of work on those particular issues, including solitary confinement. What kind of changes do you think are needed?
You need to think consistently about making conditions in jails and prisons humane and safe. Solitary confinement is a piece of that. It's very much overused in many, many jails and prisons right now. We have 80 to 100,000 people in solitary confinement on any given day. That's a crazy number, a crazy proportion. There's no reason to do that. People get rather than reserving solitary confinement for people who are really incapable of being safely housed anyplace else, what's happened is that it's become almost the place of first resort to punish prisoners for very minor disciplinary offenses.
Now, you talked earlier about productive confinement. I'm assuming you don't think solitary fits those parameters.
No, solitary is toxic. Humans are social animals, and if you take them out of social interaction with other people, they start to, many of them, people who are already vulnerable in terms of their mental health, decompensate and really get much, much worse. And even people who are reasonably resilient can start to go crazy. Some people that doesn't happen to, and they just end up tense and badly socialized. And then what happens is they get out and of solitary confinement and sometimes right out of prison, and they are in a very bad situation to try to, you know, get their lives together and to try to protect the community from them. It's not a good idea either in terms of humanity or in terms of safety.
Now, you've said that sometimes the people you believe that who are incarcerated, there could be better avenues of treatment. There could be addiction treatment needed. There could be mental health treatment. How do those prisoners, do you think, seek out those avenues? How does society funnel them towards that and maybe away from incarceration?
You know, that's a great question. And again, I think that the answer is that it has to be a very particularized, that a person who has never committed an offense before is in a very different situation than somebody who, you know, repeatedly robs people in order to supply drugs for their addiction. I mean, we're really talking about very, very different groups. So I think that it has to be worked out, you know, in pretty great detail. But what we know is that if we can create, especially, say, for people who have mental illness, if we can create different kinds of wraparound services that allow for crisis intervention teams, that instead of going to jail when things go badly, they get the crisis intervention they need and stay both on the right side of the law but also out of jail. And that's a really important intervention that a bunch of cities are beginning to try, and more need to do it.
We're going to go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We want to hear from you. Should we have maybe shorter criminal sentences? Do we need more alternatives to incarceration? Maybe looking at health, mental health treatment, addiction treatment. And if you've been part of the correction system, let us know what you think at 800-642-1234. And Susan is first in Boscobel. Susan, hi.
Hi.
What is your take?
I'm calling to say that I've been working in prisons for a very long time, and for like almost 30 years. And some people I think should be let out of prison, absolutely. But I think that some should not be also. And your guest was also talking about the segregation or lockup. In Wisconsin, we don't even refer to it that anymore. We refer to it as restricted housing.
And when you talked about how some people you feel should be released, some people shouldn't, do you have any more thoughts about how to address that question of the people you feel should and those who maybe should be released?
I think that people who continually commit crimes, they need to be rehabilitated, obviously. But I think some of the issues involved that we need to start rehabilitation before these children or these people are even born. Because, you know, so many times now it's a pattern in a family. And if we can stop that before, you know, before we start educating these kids, then I think that we could reduce some of our problems.
Well, Susan, thank you. Appreciate that call. And Margo, what about looking at sort of interventions at the social level before, earlier, far earlier, Susan is saying, before we even get to the prospect of incarceration?
You know, I think that those are good ideas, but I also think that even when somebody is offending, that we should really be thinking about how long a sentence is really needed here, and we shouldn't make it longer just because, you know, that way we get to say more sternly, well, what you just did was rotten and terrible. I think we need to remember that every added month of incarceration comes at high cost to the taxpayers and to the person and to the family. And if we're thinking about deterrence or incapacitation, either one, we should limit the amount of incarceration to what is appropriate. In terms of deterrence and incarceration, we should follow some of the evidence about what works in those areas. And so even when early intervention is great, but even when it fails and people commit criminal offenses, we need to really think in a rational and measured way about how much time that should get them.
And what kinds of things have led to what you see as these longer periods of sentencing that we have now?
I think that people kind of bid up the sentence to show that they're tougher on crime rather than thinking about, well, you know, this is a cost-benefit analysis, and there's a real cost to longer sentences. I think also that we've made conditions of probation and parole unduly onerous for some folks. And so you'll have a host of technical rules about probation or parole, either one, where violation of those technical rules, even if there is no crime being committed, can lead to significant time incarcerated, and that's not a very productive way to run a criminal justice system either.
We're talking about prison reform right now with Margo Schlanger from the University of Michigan Law School, and we're going to go next to Jim in Richland County. Jim, hi.
Hi, how are you folks today?
Good, thank you.
The reason I'm calling is that I have to go back 40 years, but I was actually incarcerated for 3 years back in the 70s. And in my opinion, the entire system has actually gone backwards since that time, because I was actually placed in a special program based on my psychological profile, and I spent 3 years going to different therapies and rehab sessions and blah, blah, all that good stuff. But one thing that I would like to point out is that our method of sentencing people is archaic based on the crime committed. The crime is not the reason that person should be committed. It's what brings that person to society's attention. But it is a symptom of something else. An analogy here is Al Capone went to prison for income tax evasion, but that's not the reason they wanted him locked up. He was a bad man, you know, psychologically and so forth. And putting someone away because they did this or did that is really ridiculous. They need to go in based on the type of personality they are. They need to be profiled professionally once they're taken in.
Jim, thank you so much for calling and sharing your experiences. A couple of things there to get at, Margo. One is, has the system gone backwards, say, since the 70s when Jim was incarcerated? And also, how do we get the system, if we agree with that premise, to treat the cause instead of the symptom, which Jim says is the crime.
Well, I mean, you know, in the 70s, we had a few hundred thousand people in jails and prisons, and now we have 2 million more than that. So there was a lot more space to treat people individually when it was so many fewer people in American prisons. And so in that sense, I think we have gone backwards. In some senses, I don't. Prisons are in many ways much more professionally run, and a lot of the abuses that were really very common in the 70s, it's not that they're invisible now or are hard to find, but they're not as common. The worst prisons in the 70s were worse than the worst prisons now. So I don't think we've gone backwards in all respects, but I do think that the mass of people that makes up mass incarceration has made it very, very difficult for professionals to take an individualized approach to the people in jails and prisons and to do the kind of thing that Jim was talking about.
Well, Jim, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate that. And Margo, thanks to you for joining us today.
No, thank you very much.
We've been speaking there with Margo Schlanger, professor of law at the University of Michigan Law School and the founder and director of the Civil Rights Litigation Clearinghouse. And we've been talking about this week's national news on mass incarceration and prison reform. Here's a question for you. Hearts or stars? Well, if you're a regular user of Twitter, you might have an opinion about this. If you're not, well, that might not mean anything to you.
Starting today, that social media platform made a change in the way users express approval of other people's tweets. Until yesterday, you clicked a star to mark a tweet as a favorite. Starting today, you click a heart to like a tweet.
Quoting from a Twitter announcement, "We know that at times the star could be confusing, especially to newcomers. You might like a lot of things, but not everything can be your favorite. The heart, they say, in contrast, is a universal symbol that resonates across languages, cultures, and time zones."
As with any fairly small, innocuous change on the internet, this one was met with confusion, outrage, humor, and sarcasm. A few of the sample responses across the Twitterverse, these were on Twitter itself. "Dear Twitter, always getting it wrong. Your stars were infinitely better. Stars last eons. Hearts, on the other hand, easily broken."
And I like this one. "Twitter sure knows how to make me feel like a teenage girl again."
And one writer said, "Now I have to think," if she's not getting those hearts, "why don't they love me?"
And another person says, "I don't like the hashtag hearts for faves. It devalues love."
So do you have, I don't have an opinion. I'm an occasional Twitter user. I basically use it for a job to see what's happening out there. I never tweet. You?
I tweet occasionally. I like the whole debate about hearts and stars because it makes me think of Lucky Charms.
Right. Yummy. Now I want Lucky Charms.
And who doesn't
Charms?
Like Lucky Charms?
Thanks for that. Well, you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. And remember to heart like all of our tweets as well. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time.